Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. On this Politics Monday, we take a deeper dive into the phenomenon of strongmen, beginning with Benito Mussolini and continuing to the present with Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, among others. The tactics and characteristics of authoritarians are almost always the same, and so is their language.
Mothers and children trapped in poverty in our inner cities, rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the landscape of our nation, an education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge, and the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Those, of course, are the words of Donald Trump from his 2017 inauguration. These men, and so far they are all men, rely on propaganda, corruption, violence, and a shared sense of grievance to win popularity and justify their actions. Ruth Ben-Ghiat takes an in-depth look at Mussolini, Hitler, Gaddafi, Putin, Trump, and others in her new book, Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you.
Now, Ruth, I should mention, in addition to your writing, you are a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, and your first job, I believe, was here at UNC Charlotte.
That's right. I was at UNC Charlotte for about 4 years and lived in Fourth Ward and loved it.
Very good. Well, welcome back to Charlotte, in a way. In Strongmen, you break up the book into three sections: getting to power, the tools of rule, and losing power. Well, let's start with how these men get to power. You have the fascist leaders such as Mussolini in Italy. You have Hitler in Germany. You have the military coups such as Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and you have new authoritarian paths such as these quasi-legitimate elections. Vladimir Putin would be an example of that, and Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. These are all characters in your book, obviously real life characters. But one of the most interesting observations you make is that most strongmen are surprised to reach the top. Having just lived through the Trump presidency, I think many Americans would be surprised how common his sort of fluky rise to power is and was. Why is that?
Well, so what the book was doing is trying to find patterns. And of course, it's written as an American trying to understand, you know, what happened to us under the Trump presidency. And so one thing we see is that when there's been periods of big change and social emancipation, could be gender, racial equity, workers' rights. This leaves many people, some overjoyed and some anxious and angry. And so these men, many of them come from outside of politics. Many have a past in the media. Mm-hmm. So Mussolini was a journalist, Mobutu in the Congo was a journalist, and they know how to speak to people, how to use the tools of the day to present themselves, and how to be what people need them to be. So they're opportunists, and they are like shapeshifters. So every time they have certain, you know, obsessions and certain beliefs, of course, but every time they know how to take advantage of situation, and they are amazed at how people fold to them, how people crumble, and powerful elites and, you know, grassroots come and they have personality cults. And so this is one of the saddest things, is that they didn't expect to get this far, most of them, and instead they did.
Well, and, you know, as I read that in the book, I immediately thought of the footage of the day that then President-elect Trump went to the White House and met with President Obama. And you could see on his face, he was shocked and almost, you know, just overwhelmed that he was even in the room in a way. At least that's the way I think a lot of people interpreted it. That's the way I certainly did. So without him saying that, I guess, is that the way you interpret his rise to power here?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things I found is that these tools of rule that you mentioned, the corruption, the propaganda, I also have virility or like hypermasculinity, incitements to violence, they use them on the way to power, and not just in the fascist era, but let's just stick to today. What they do is they throw out these trial balloons, because these are men who have often inhabited a world in between the legal and the illegal, like in their business practices, or they can pose as tough men like Bolsonaro in Brazil and Duterte. So they throw out these outrageous, they say these outrageous things. They threaten people, which isn't normally what you do as a candidate. When Trump said in the end of January 2016, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose any followers, I ran home to do an op-ed because I became even more scared. Because this was a red flag. And so what they're doing, they're testing. They're saying, how much can the system bend to accommodate me? And at most, and at every step of the way, they find, far from being punished, which in the case of Trump would have been not getting the nomination or have been excluded, so that this was even way earlier than he got the nomination, he was rewarded. So this is how it starts. And they start lying, they start threatening violence, they start talking about their virility. And so all of this starts before they get to power.
Now, I'm wondering how hard it was for you. Maybe it wasn't hard at all, but how, you know, was there any hesitancy as Trump begins to run in, I guess, 2015, he comes down the escalator and all these things start to happen. The comments about immigrants and, you know, the quote you just mentioned about shooting someone on Fifth Avenue. For a lot of people, you know, Trump was a joke in many ways. And even after the 4 years that we've had, I think some people would blanch when you put him next to Mussolini or Hitler or even Gaddafi or Mobutu. And so I'm wondering whether you had any trouble reconciling him with those other examples of strongmen.
Yeah. So it's very important that the book is not kind of comparative politics. So, like, for example, I've been studying fascism for many years since I was teaching it in Charlotte. A long time ago, it's a history of the evolution of authoritarianism. So it's three periods of history. So there's the fascist era, there's military coups, and there's today, where people come in through elections, and some of them don't destroy democracy, like Silvio Berlusconi's in the book. He never destroys democracy, but he really harms it, mm-hmm. and he's able to bend the law to his own private needs. Right, So I'm not saying that, for example, I don't call Trump a fascist. Many people push me to call him a fascist because I'm an expert in fascism. But he uses tactics, and the book shows how some tactics like personality cults and lying, like institutionalized lying, normalizing extremists, these come from fascism, but they work differently today. We don't have a one-party state today, except, you know, North Korea or China, but that's less the norm today. Mm-hmm. So it's the first book that puts him in historical context of a century, but it's not intended to say he's like Gaddafi, because that would be absurd, right?
Right.
That wouldn't be historical.
It's more the evolution. I mean, I interpreted it as the evolution and how, you know, it's a more polished form of authoritarianism, I guess, in the current age.
It's so authoritarianism in its most basic is when you have a system where the executive, the leader, kind of comes to prevail and often squishes completely the other branches, you know, judicial. And historically, like classic, you know, dictatorships, of course, there was only one party state, no opposition allowed. So today things work a bit differently. They come to power via elections, and they manipulate elections to stay there. So like in Turkey, Erdogan has imprisoned hundreds of thousands of people. There's still elections. He's made himself president and prime minister. So that's a good example of the executive coming to prevail over other things. So today it works differently. And the things that Trump was trying to do, his aspirations, his character matches very well these people, but the outcome is very different today.
That is the voice of Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of the new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. I suspect a lot of readers may have an experience similar to the one I had, and that is I nodded my head over and over as I read about the commonalities of these leaders. You write that they, quote, promise law and order and then enable lawless behavior by financial and sexual predators. That's just one of many examples that are in this book. But why do so many people overlook that disconnect as it's happening?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It's about character, right? When our systems don't have proper vetting of candidates, this is the example I gave before, what these men do is that they end up normalizing and kind of channeling existing anti-democratic and anti-extremist and extremist tendencies. And they themselves make them what the culture most wants at that time. And so, but to do that, it's because they are very, they're opportunists, they're lawless themselves. Many of them have come to office with a criminal record. Mussolini and Hitler both had criminal record or a long history of kind of, many court cases, again, inhabiting the world of the legal versus the illegal. And Trump has been involved in over 3,500 legal cases. Berlusconi, the same. Erdogan, the same. Erdogan had over 2,000 insult suits, as they're called. Anybody he thought was insulting him, he would sue. Mm-hmm. So they have a common personality of extremely fragile egos that are compensated for by aggressiveness and a willingness to do anything that it takes to get to power and to stay to power. So they're very dangerous individuals. And over again, either this is something that many people want, this lawlessness, or they don't see it in time and their systems don't have vetting processes adequate to keep them out.
I want to ask you, you make the point again in the book that a public health emergency such as COVID-19 exposes strongmen because these kinds of crises demand transparency and accountability. And I'm wondering, what do you think would have happened in this past election without the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, Trump got over 70 million votes, and I think it's very important. You know, it's very easy, and historically it's happened many times, to start not taking the person seriously all over again, which was part of when they come to power, people think they're clowns and they're not going to be, they'll calm down once they get in office, and then that doesn't happen. But when they're going out, there's a human tendency to want to forget about them and minimize their impact. But I think that the pandemic definitely hurt Trump with some people, the kind of criminal negligence, as I see it, that he showed. And there were people who had been Trump followers and had believed the pandemic was COVID was a hoax, made videos, and these, apparently affected a lot of people. But we have to focus on how many votes he still got. And here it's a testament to his truly, truly, truly amazing personality cult that he was able to build. And despite the pandemic, he still has the solidarity and loyalty of many, many people.
More with Ruth Ben-Ghiat coming up on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday, and my guest is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is a professor of history and Italian studies at NYU and a former professor at UNC Charlotte. We're discussing her new book, which is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. You mentioned Berlusconi earlier in the show, and I'm wondering, to me, he seems the most similar to Trump? You mentioned the media background, and obviously Trump with The Apprentice, a little bit different. Berlusconi owned basically the entire media industry in Italy, but similar backgrounds, both shadowed by all kinds of sexual controversy, ethical controversies. Do you see a similar pattern with those two, or is there someone else in the book that you would say is more similar to Trump than Berlusconi?
No, Berlusconi is a very good, he was a very important predecessor, because he came in the 90s, briefly in 1994, so it was the end of the Cold War, right? And he is the first person, he's a lot of firsts, he's a real pioneer. He was the first person to bring the neo-fascists into government in Italy. So he started this whole normalization of the far right that is very much with us today all over the world now. He also he was a billionaire. He owned soccer teams, he owned TV networks. So he was very well placed to build a personality cult. And he was so effective at this that I found this citation, and I went and looked it up because I couldn't believe it, that these researchers on Alzheimer's were interviewing people. And there was a woman who didn't recognize her family anymore, which is common with this disease. But she knew three people, the faces of the Pope, of Jesus Christ, and Berlusconi. And this is after he had been in power once, and he was being in power again. So he was very important because he did not destroy democracy. There was a very vociferous opposition. And indeed, this is a cautionary tale. He was voted out after 5 years of government in 2006. Because he was corruption, and he promised all these miracles, make Italy great again, which he had a slogan. But then he got back in 2008, and he was more corrupt than ever. And the main thing he did was he had endless judicial woes and charges of corruption. And so, for example, when he was accused of bribery, he got Parliament to pass a law making bribery a lesser offense. And these were called ad personam laws. They were to his person. So he managed to domesticate the party so it became a tool of smearing his enemies and defending him. And so when these people are in government, even if they don't wreck democracy in the old-fashioned way, they end up, governance becomes all about them, about protecting them, smearing their enemies, defending them. And we've seen this with Trump and the GOP. So I can't tell you the number of ways Berlusconi demonized migrants. He was one of the first to detain migrants. The whole formula for this kind of rule was set by him.
And you mentioned that he was out of power and came back to power. We're hearing all kinds of speculation about whether Trump may declare his 2024 candidacy on Inauguration Day. So it sounds like you think that is a plausible scenario that Trump could run in 24 or 28 and perhaps win?
Well, so there's two. One thing I always say is once these people get into power, it's very difficult to get them out. And if you read the book, you will appreciate all the more what we have done by voting out Trump. And you've seen how difficult it's been to get him to admit that he's been voted out. He still hasn't. He will never really admit it. And so with Berlusconi, though, there's other lessons there. So he was voted out in 2006, and the center-left, reformist, left, came in. And there were great expectations that they would pass anti-corruption laws because these men exploit the loopholes that we have in our system, and they're expert, and they've always done that in their private lives. Trump has armies of accountants and lawyers. That's his business model, to push back on everything. So what he's been doing with the election is what he's done always, to avoid paying taxes, right, and get rid of lawsuits.
The Roy Cohn, Michael Cohen, yeah.
Yes, yeah. By the way, his mentors, like Roger Stone, worked for other dictators in the book. Roger Stone and Paul Manafort worked for Mobutu. They worked for Ferdinand Marcos. So the people around Trump are really expert in this kind of authoritarian playbook. But getting back to Berlusconi, but they, the The center left didn't really want to, they didn't want to make that their identity, like being negative against Berlusconi now that he was out. They wanted to turn the page and move forward. Excuse me. So they didn't do much. And people got so angry that this is when kind of far-right populism became popular, and Berlusconi got back in. Less than 2 years later, he was voted back in.
You mentioned virility, one of the characteristics of strongmen. And before we went on the air, I was telling you that that was probably the most disturbing chapter, in my opinion. I mean, you go through rapes and sexual assaults, forced abortions, all kinds of abuses by these strong men over the past century, and also the imaging. And I think, you know, of things like Vladimir Putin riding shirtless on horseback. And I'm wondering, maybe this is an obvious thing, but I'm going to ask you anyway, which is, you know, this tie-in, how does this tie in to dismissing female leaders? You have the example of Putin trying to intimidate Angela Merkel by sort of threatening her with a dog that's nearby because she's scared of dogs. We obviously know that Trump is still chanting, or his crowds are still chanting, lock her up, at Hillary Clinton 4 years after the election. How do you see those things tying together?
I added this chapter on virility because, so I used a lot of political science data sets and all kinds of studies. And I saw that they didn't have much room for masculinity. And I wanted to take seriously this kind of hyper-masculinity and all that it means in terms of gender and power hierarchies, because it's really integral to their rule. So it's easy for us to look at, you know, Mussolini and Putin are the bookends of the leaders that strip their shirts off, right? And they show their pecs and they use their bodies very well. Trump, I couldn't include this in the book because of copyright reasons, but Trump doesn't show his own body. He borrows other men's bodies. So he, in 2019, he tweeted from his personal account. It wasn't even a retweet. He photoshopped his head onto Sylvester Stallone's body in Rocky and sent that out from his personal account. So they use their bodies. But virility is also, it's as though in the cases of Berlusconi a bit, but Gaddafi and Mussolini, it's as though Jeffrey Epstein was at the head of a state and could use all the state resources for his personal, you know, sex ring and procurement operation. So I wrote about those, and they were not easy to write about, how they would scout for women. If you wrote Mussolini a letter, and you included a photo, he would have his, you know, secret police. He had an army of people working to procure him women for his sex addiction, basically. And Gaddafi went a step further and he kept them captive.
And Gaddafi was sort of scouting when he would go make a speech at a college or a school.
Yeah, it was terrible. And he had like a sex dungeon built under the University of Tripoli. And the irony with Gaddafi is that he's the only socialist in the book, and he's there because he's connected in many ways to Berlusconi and to Mussolini. But he was the great emancipator of women. He did a lot for women. He gave them property rights and he educated them. But this is the paradox of these men, who all of them mobilize women and they often hire women. Putin has many high-ranking women. Trump had, you know, Betsy DeVos, and Kellyanne Conway was the first woman to run a major campaign. But their policies, they're very misogynistic, and their policies, also sometimes in alliance with religious institutions, are designed to curb female emancipation. So there's a lot of paradoxes about what they do on the gender front. And Gaddafi kind of symbolizes this, you know, revolution was for women, and then he was keeping women captive in sex dungeons.
That is the voice of Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. And you write about this, about the flip side of this hyper-masculinity, which is hypersensitivity. And here's how you put it in the book. You say, quote, "Hell hath no fury like a strong man in a bad mood. And when I read that, I immediately thought of the numerous reports all of us have read in recent weeks describing how Trump aides have tried to gently nudge the president toward accepting that he had lost the election. It is, as you put it, I mean, they're just fearful to even deliver bad news, much less challenge him.
Yeah, this is one of the, I didn't expect to find how similar these men were. So they create these structures of governance that are, I call them cocoons or inner sanctums. They can't stand to hear anything that's not their version of the truth. They're very hypersensitive. So they surround themselves with flatterers, sycophants, and if you're too competent or too popular, you get booted out because they can't. They have to be the top dog, the alpha male. They also surround themselves with family. And I have a paragraph in the book about the role of sons-in-law from Mussolini's son-in-law, who he made foreign minister and later had executed, up to our own Jared Kushner. But many of them have sons-in-law very active. And the whole purpose of this is to shield them from any realities they don't want. So we see this now with, you know, these news stories. And what's been so interesting for me is that because we've remained a democracy with a free press, all the whole chronicle of all the tell-all books, all the things we learn from journalists about how the Trump world operates, down to what you just said, we normally learn these things about these governments only after they leave, their leaders are gone, through memoirs or people who go into exile and do their own tell-all books, right? But we've been able to see that it's the same structure. Again, the outcome is different, but it's the same structure of rule. And the whining, so, and then the other thing about this paradoxical masculinity is that they pose as the alpha male, right? We talked about the pecs and all this. And Putin, you know, has to put down Angela Merkel because she's his equal. They can have women work for them, but they can't have a female equal. But they also appeal to women because they're always the victim. Mm-hmm. And the cult of victimhood is really important to this kind of ruler. In fact, if you want to know, if you see someone on the horizon, are they going to be a strongman type? Start watching if they're going to talk about themselves as victims. So people feel protective of them. So many in all of the, like Berlusconi had a huge fan base among housewives. And he talked about witch hunts as well. He used the same terms as Trump.
I noticed that. I was going to, and let me go ahead and ask you about it since you mentioned it. Yeah. As you said, I think it was his companies were facing ethical or bribery charges. I can't remember what the charges were, but he described it as a witch hunt. And obviously, that's all we heard from Trump on Twitter about the Mueller report and impeachment. It is uncanny. And I'm wondering, let me expand the question a little bit. I'm wondering if, as you came into this, if you knew or anticipated that so many things would be similar, from the language and the tactics and the strategies and the characteristics of this century of strongmen?
No, the short answer, no. Because I'd worked on Mussolini, I'd worked on propaganda. Of course, I taught what much broader scope of things, but I in no way expected to, look, in the introduction, I have a quote from the American ambassador to the Congo, which Mobutu renamed Zaire. And he says, you know, he was extremely thin-skinned about any imagined slights to his presidency. And anyway, there were all these quotes I would find about different leaders, and they could match Trump exactly. So, or Mussolini, or so part of what the book does is shows these recurrences. And one of them, part of this kind of having flatterers around you, you also, the leader also wants to humiliate people. That's part of this being the alpha male, is you humiliate everyone else around you because you're insecure. So one practice is you fire people in the most humiliating way possible. So I have a line in the book where in 1931, the head of the fascist party found out he was fired by reading in the newspaper.
Twitter of the day.
Yes. And then Mobutu used to organize rallies and then publicly, and they would be on TV. And then people would find out, you know, his officials in front of everybody, they were fired. And here we have in 2018, Rex Tillerson, was sitting on the toilet, apparently scrolling through Twitter, and found out he was fired. So these are these patterns of that come from these men having a similar character.
You truly can't make it up.
No.
we discussed misinformation and disinformation a little bit. A related observation you make in the book is that authoritarians tend to be masters of new forms of communication. And you just mentioned Trump and Twitter, obviously. Why is that important in their success and ability to influence politically?
It's huge because not only they're extremely savvy in presenting themselves and being what people need them to be at that moment, very early on, they understand, and this is why some of them are called populists. I don't really use that term because that doesn't apply to all of them, but they establish a direct communications channel with the people. And that directness is really important. It's an unmediated contact. So they can, and they, it's interesting that personality cults started at the time of Hollywood cinema. Mussolini had a big one, and there were, you know, in communism worked a bit differently, but those were the first cults in the 20s and then the 30s and Hitler. And speaking directly to the people allowed them to claim when they were still rising to power that the establishment media was against them and they could be truth tellers. So I have a photo of a Nazi poster from the 20s before Hitler got into office, where he's pictured with duct tape over his mouth or whatever the equivalent was in 20s Germany, because he was being silenced and canceled, you'd say today, mm-hmm. by the democratic media because he was telling the truth. So then once they get into office, they have this direct channel and they build these bonds of loyalty and they monopolize the media. And so you see that Trump had disadvantages compared to other leaders. So he doesn't own TV networks like Berlusconi. There's an open, we have an open media society, but he still managed to make himself 24/7 the center of everybody's attention. And he did this mostly through Twitter and also through Fox News.
I'm glad you mentioned Fox News. I want to talk a little bit about Fox News and their role in the Trump presidency and his nomination to become president. We'll have more with Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the President. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Hale.
And I'm Jill Bieres. And on the latest episode of the Work It podcast, we're taking a deeper look at love.
By introducing you to a wedding planner, a therapist, and a veterinarian.
I think that animals are the only beings that are really capable of unconditional love.
Listen to the Work It podcast on wfee.org/workit or wherever you find podcasts.
Support for Work It comes from Carolina Asthma and Allergy Center.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday, and my guest today is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the President. And as we were going to the break, you mentioned Fox News, and we have had almost a cottage industry of analysis on how much of a role Fox News has played in Trump's rise and his continuing popularity. How do you see the relationship between Fox and Trump and how important that is to Trump's political career?
I see Fox as a kind of co-producer of the Trump presidency. And one thing that's very different about Trump than all the other leaders in the book is, you know, even Berlusconi owned TV networks and no one was better at TV than he was, but he read, he actually read books. He read his briefing, you know, materials, his dossiers on foreign policy. Trump doesn't read. And so he gets all his information about the world from television and he watches, as we know, you know, many, many hours. So what was different is that usually the press would kind of parrot what the leader says. But in Trump's case, there was like a feedback loop established with Fox and Sean Hannity and some of those hosts that he most relies on. So, you know, there have been documented by journalists where, you know, Hannity would say something and then it would become a presidential tweet, you know, 3 minutes later. So who is making policy? Who, when we look at the archive of Trump's tweets, whose ideas are these? But another relevant thing is that one of the principles of strongmen, because they're amoral opportunists, they turn on anyone. And so I have some bleak phrase in the book about they use and discard everybody. So it's very typical. I was like kind of laughing to myself when I saw that the Trump world was turning on Fox News because they you know, accepted some of the election results very early, and they actually declared, you know, Biden the winner, and he couldn't accept that. So now that's the end, except for certain, you know, hosts right. who are keeping the fight going. As a network, he's moved on.
Yeah, now he's with Newsmax and One America.
Yeah, right. This is typical. So they invested all this time, and of course they gained in ratings and profits hugely from it. So Rupert Murdoch is a very pragmatic person. They got a lot out of it, but it's very symptomatic that is the second they're not going to be loyal and submissive, they're out. That's how these men are.
I want to read you a quote from Michael Steele. He's the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. He recently told the Washington Post that Trump, quote, wants the party to continue to be consumed by him and his madness, end quote. How plausible is it that Trump can hold the party and his voters in thrall once he leaves the White House?
Yeah, there's differing views on this. I don't know yet what will be. I have been astonished and yet also not surprised that Trump has succeeded in domesticating the GOP to the extent he has. And here history is a really interesting comparison, because people have done this in the past. Mussolini created his own party, or let's stick to Berlusconi because it's more, you know, relevant. He created his own party, Forza Italia. It was his. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it became his personal instrument to do all his, you know, vendettas and all this stuff. But Trump came from outside. I mean, yes, he was, you know, flirting with politics and from, you know, around 2011, 12. But he came from outside and the grand old party has a very grand old history. And in 4 short years, he made it completely his tool, to the point where, you know, the 2020 program of the party had no ideological content that was new, except we are going to support Trump. And I was very struck by when the Senate acquitted him, Sherrod Brown, the Democratic senator, went around to the GOP colleagues and off the record and asked them why they acquitted him. And they all said they were afraid. They voted out of fear. So this kind of intimidation tactics, this is, again, we are not in democratic with a small d territory. We are in authoritarian territory. So the fate after he leaves, what will happen to, you know, he's kept all these voters. He's kept these certain loyalists. The GOP hasn't even admitted formally. Only a few of them have admitted that he lost the election. So he could very well keep them. He won't have the same clout, but he collects information on people. He could still harm people, whether he's in office or not.
In the book, you also write about the lingering effects of what you call an oppressive presence and policies, you know, when you're dealing with a country that has had a strong man as a leader. So what do you see as the aftershocks, if you will, of the Trump presidency, and what will it take to curb those damaging effects?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very difficult to get rid of their toxicity, because the reason they had such success in the first place is because they channeled into things that were already there. So a lot of the background causes, whether it's racism or, you know, toward African-Americans, migrants, all of these things are not going away. The demographic changes to the United States that scare people are not going away. So it's those root causes, and the GOP, you know, Trump may be leaving, but the GOP is still there, Mitch McConnell. So I think that we have to be very, and many people cast a scenario where somebody worse than Trump will come along. And I don't know if that will happen, but It's very clear that 2024, they're already mobilizing for 2024, whether it's going to be Trump or somebody else. And there could be a scenario where he's trying to make things as difficult as possible in going out the door for Biden, trying to sabotage the success of Biden's administration. And this too is completely typical. And I have examples in the, at the final chapter of Strongmen of Pinochet in Chile, the only dictator ever voted out. He had over a year before he had to leave, and he spent the whole time trying to sabotage the new democracy coming in, like stacking the Supreme Court and all kinds of stuff. So that is worrisome, that he could try and hamstring and create crises for the Biden administration, he and the GOP.
You mentioned that so far, you mentioned in the book, I should say, that so far we've only had strongmen. But you know that someone like Marine Le Pen in France, or perhaps Ivanka Trump, could become future authoritarian rulers. How much difference, if any, do you think gender would make if that scenario played out?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. So I didn't include female leaders in the book. There's, you know, I could have had Indira Gandhi, you know, Golda Meir, Thatcher. But I wanted, the reason I didn't include them is that I wanted to isolate this kind of workings of virility and how it intersects with corruption and this fetish of a certain kind of brute force, male force, that I think has caused us a lot of trouble when it becomes policy, right? Mm-hmm. And I've got plenty of female perpetrators in the book, torturers and other people. So it's not a message that, you know, women good, men bad, and we should have leaders accordingly. So at the end, I speculate, and there's many women who are prominent in the far right in Europe and elsewhere. And I think it's just a matter of time that one of them becomes the head of state. Le Pen in France is a little unusual because she's there because her father founded this movement. But there are younger women who could be the first one day. And I don't think this is going to change much. They're not going to be stripping their shirts off and showing their, you know, muscles. But the racism, the you know, the anti-globalization, all of that stuff, the corruption. Ivanka is a highly, highly corrupt and skilled corrupt operative on the international financial scale. That will all continue. That's not going to change because the underlying causes that lead people to seek out these kind of authoritarian movements are applicable to men and women.
We're speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. We had a week ago on the show, we had Thomas Ricks talking about his new book about the founding fathers and what shaped their views. And of course, we drifted into current events. And one of the things that he mentioned was that a silver lining in this era is that we have collectively been in sort of a forced constitutional law class, that we are, you know, all paying much closer attention to how the Constitution was put together, you know, how the branches of government interact, what their powers are. You mentioned in the book, you talk about the Washington Post and the New York Times and other journalism outlets that have really thrived during the Trump era as we have this near constant stress test of our government. Do you see that as any kind of silver lining amid all the chaos of the past 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I do. This has been like an enormous democracy education civics class for so many, because, you know, it makes sense that we would say, oh, it can't happen here. And that we would only have a democratic frame of reference to view Trump's actions, because we haven't had a dictatorship. We haven't had a foreign occupation. So democracy is what we know, although, you know, it's been a very limited democracy since African-Americans, they got the vote rather recently. We've had, it's woken up many people to the fact that their rights are more fragile than they thought, that it's easy to take for granted our freedoms, And I think in particular, the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer, which were mixed race attendance, have a lot of white people have woken up to the fact that their rights are more easily taken away. And I'm pretty convinced that had Trump been reelected, men like William Barr, Attorney General, were waiting to enact certain, you know, authoritarian direction things they'd been wanting to do for a long time. So we really, you could say, dodged a bullet. You could say turned back a process that was going on. what we did in the election was truly great. And I think that although many, many people didn't vote, I think a whole new generation has been mobilized. That's a really good thing.
You mentioned the circumstances in Italy back earlier in the 2000s. And I think you said there was a hesitancy to kind of go back and relitigate some of what had happened with Berlusconi. Let me stop there. Did I understand you correctly on that aspect?
Yeah.
Okay. So that then leads to a very obvious question as we come into a new administration. And we've seen this before. When President Obama came in, his administration opted not to go back and relitigate some of the allegations of torture, with the war in Iraq, Abu Ghraib. What do you think is going to happen with the Biden administration in terms of looking back at some of the things that went on in the Trump administration and whether there would be any willingness to closer examine, laws that could have been broken?
I think until now, Biden's had a, message of just unity and calm and moving forward. And I think that it was good to have that because, Trump wasn't even accepting the outcome. And many people were worried about civil unrest. And many people on the Trump side wanted civil unrest, all the militia groups. So I think that there's a reason to have this kind of consoling, calm voice. But I do think it would be a mistake to just to not address the problems in our system, the weaknesses and loopholes in the system that allowed Trump to do so much of what he did legally. And history shows that that's, and it sends a message to all the GOP, because it's not just Trump, right? It's a lot of somebody like Lindsey Graham, somebody in Barr who I think felt very liberated by being able to be more lawless and stretch the boundaries of what was accepted. And this is one of the thrills that strongmen, that's one of their appeals to men and women, that you can be liberated from convention. So I think that if you don't push back, addressing problems and uphold transparency and accountability, especially, we're in for a worse time later on.
In our closing minute or so, let's try and end on a little bit of a happier note. What gives you optimism, if anything, as you look at our country and then the next few years and how things may change?
Well, the election gives me huge optimism. Also, the outcome of the midterm elections, which brought historic number of women and people of color into government, so that government will look more like the country it governs. Also, what we said before about a new sensitivity and sensibility about protecting democracy. And I think already the cabinet choices and other choices the Biden-Harris administration is making are setting us up to have a new tone that certainly is very different than the one of the last 4 years.
Well, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, she is the author of Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and she is a former UNC Charlotte history professor. We thank her for the time. We thank you for joining us here on Politics Monday. Mike Collins will be back with you tomorrow. I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.